The reason being, okay, this will be mainly on the blackboard. I will only show some pictures at the end. The reason being that I learned during this workshop that there are all these nice acronyms like DMFT and LDA plus DMFT. So algebra, analysis, and applications of the RG is ARG. That's also what some people say when they first see how this method looks. But in fact, it's a very beautiful method. You just have to kiss the frog before the beauty comes out. So this is algebra, analysis, and applications. So the applications, I will show some pictures and discuss them. Algebra is what you would call formalism. Analysis is what you would call formalism, and applications are applications. So, first about the idea of the method. It's of course just one variant of the renormalization group. And the idea is that one takes some scale, some parameter, typically an energy scale, and one decreases it and looks what happens. When I say energy scale, it's not really true. It's actually a kinetic energy scale. So it's not the total energy that is decreased or studied, but it's the kinetic energy. So one does something to the kinetic energy part of the action. And then, of course, this flow parameter gets lower and lower because it actually plays the role of an infrared cutoff. And so there have been questions whether this makes sense once the cutoff is smaller than the potential energy, right? Because then the energy of the potential energy is then larger. The answer is, of course, it makes sense. The only question is whether the back reaction to the self-energy gets larger than the cutoff. At the latest, then this method doesn't work anymore. But I mean, it's been shown in many examples that it works when the down to lambda equal to zero, even at fixed couplings. So you should keep in mind when I discuss this now that I'm mainly interested in the Hubbard model. So you have the usual U, T, T prime, and so on. So for the moment, it's not going to be important the hopping is. We just assume some hopping amplitudes, T, X, Y. Later, when it becomes specific, we will take T and T prime non-zero. So however, one of the advantages of the method that you're very flexible in dealing with more complicated stuff here. Also, it doesn't just have to be an on-site loop. It could be a quite general interaction. But from what I told you already, that we are first looking at the kinetic energy, it's clear that it's a weak coupling method. So U is going to be small at the beginning. And although I've, during my short stay here, heard many times that there is nothing new in weak coupling, I actually don't agree. It's not so easy, I find. But okay. Well, so much for the general idea of the method. Why does one use the RG at all, or something of that type, on such a problem? The reason for it is very simple. If the kinetic energy has a minimum value, lambda is positive. Lambda should be the cutoff for the kinetic energy. And if U is small, then perturbation theory is convergent, so you know what you're doing. So there is a well-defined starting point if lambda is large. And then, of course, this convergence of perturbation theory is, of course, not uniform in lambda. It gets worse and worse as lambda decreases, and so one studies piece by piece when one goes downwards. Okay, so let's start with
algebra of the method.
Well, we just assume that we have the usual generating functional that you all know and have seen very often. Source terms. And so, of course, you know this expression. This is a Grassmann integral. These fermion variables replace the C's and C daggers in the functional integral formulation. I use a shorthand here, which is, for instance, eta bar psi, which is in the case we are looking at this usual thing, integral 0 to beta p tau sum over x eta alpha tau x bar psi alpha tau x. So I'll never write this again. Just to be specific what it means, it's just a formal analog of an inner product of two functions. Okay, so we have source terms. If we differentiate with respect to eta bar, we get some psi down and so on. Now the Q in our case for the Hubbard model is just going to be, well, let me just write it down. That's the usual thing. I'll just go now immediately to Fourier variables. So it's psi bar alpha of omega and p I omega minus EFP psi alpha of omega and p. Omega is omega n. That's bar frequencies, and EFP is epsilon of p minus mu. Epsilon of p comes from this hopping object here. So it's just the standard functional integral. V is the potential coming from, for instance, the Hubbard model. So you know all this very well. And now what we're going to do is we're going to change this piece here. So let's call this Q of P. So now we are replacing Q by Q lambda. I write it here. Q goes to Q lambda. For instance, Q lambda of P is Q of P times chi lambda of P inverse. So the idea here, chi lambda could be a function h of whatever, q of p squared, lambda squared, and h, something like this. So what am I doing here? I'm introducing a cutoff on the propagator. You know the propagator is the inverse of this q, so c lambda is q lambda inverse is just 1 over I omega minus E times a cutoff function. So we introduce an energy cutoff in the kinetic energy part. That's what I told you. Now, there is no reason why you have to do it this way. There are many different ways. In fact, there is one way of doing it by using the temperature itself as a flow parameter. For the following algebraic thing, it will not be important, of course, once one starts actually doing things for a specific model. Different methods are no longer a priori equivalent. So we change Q lambda somehow, so we should put in this here. Now we get a generating functional with an infrared cutoff lambda. And how do we get the renormalization group equation? We just differentiate this with respect to lambda. So we apply d lambda. Well, then it's obviously this comes down psi bar q dot lambda psi. So dot is the derivative with respect to lambda. Well, and the only thing that source terms are always good for is that you can rewrite this, of course, this action as or whatever, d by d eta q dot lambda d by d eta bar. And so you see that the flow equation is of the form Laplacian dot lambda e to the minus w lambda is the derivative with respect to lambda. So this is the Laplacian. So that's already the flow equation. We can take the derivative, so we get w dot lambda. Well, you see here, of course, this is the first derivative, just brings this down times the exponential. Here we've got a second order operator, so we get two terms. The first term is the one where, the first derivative takes down the w, and the second derivative acts on it again, so we get this. And then we get one term where exponent gets it twice. So we get a quadratic differential equation for w. Already the renormalization group equation for w. So you see the derivation is really very simple, and it only depends on the assumption that we only have this part depend on lambda. Of course, if we did make v depend on lambda, then this thing would be a bit more complicated. You could still write down some equation, it would be of higher order, of course. Didn't appear to be very useful, so who knows. Now, to proceed, one notices, of course, that it's not a very convenient thing to have an inverse cutoff function, because the inverse cutoff function just looks like this. And of course, it suppresses integration over modes with low value of q. But you actually want to have things in terms of these propagators with chi lambda. So at this point, the method splits into n different methods, let's say, depending on what function you study. There is one possibility to study the one-particle irreducible functions, which I'm going to discuss in the following. And there is another studying the so-called effective action. Well, many things are called effective action, but that's just a variant of w where you rescale the sources. So since I never remember what the precise thing is, let me write it down here. So one can also study g lambda of psi bar and psi constant minus an explicit quadratic term. Okay, if you do this, then you will get an equation g lambda dot is of almost the same form as the old one. Except that because of this amputation here, you actually don't get the inverse of the propagator here in the Laplacian, but the propagator g lambda itself. This equation is known as Polchinski's equation. It has been extremely useful in many studies of renormalization in many models. So this is not restricted to fermions. You can do it in completely general theories. The other way one can proceed is, well, still further changing this to a weak ordered function, which has even more advantages, but I won't go into this. If you want to see, for instance, the equation for the one particle irreducible functions, which we're going to study in more detail then, you just remember how the gamma is defined. Well, gamma is the Legendre transform. So gamma lambda depends on two fields, phi bar and phi. And in fact, these fields are just these derivatives. If you remember the Legendre transform, this is phi, and by the sign convention, this should be minus phi bar. And so you see you can very easily rewrite this equation, because this equation contains a second derivative of W. And if you remember Legendre transform, the second derivative of W is just the inverse of the second derivative of gamma. So I'm not going to go into the details, but it's really a three-line thing to convince yourself that the generating function of gamma for the 1pi functions has this flow equation. This term is exactly that one. I think the sign changes. Yeah. Don't pin me down on signs in this. If you flip the derivatives, you get the sign. So this is the differential equation for the 1pi functions. Now, of course, in this way, it may look pretty weird. It actually has a very simple interpretation, which brings us to the end of the algebraic part of the story. And the interpretation is as follows. We all know that the functional gamma generates the 1pi functions. So gamma actually looks as follows. There is a quadratic part. And then there is a part which contains stuff of higher order in these five variables. So this is m 2 to infinity. It's actually possible to prove the convergence of this series. This here is the inverse of the full propagator. And the object with 2m here is just of order 2m in the fields, and that just means it's the 2m point irreducible function, which I graphically just denote by this. So it goes from 1 to 2m. So in other words, all this equation tells you is you read from the quadratic part, you read off the inverse of the full propagator. From the higher order parts, you read off the effective vertices, the one particle irreducible vertices.
Big phi is phi and phi bar, right?
Yeah, this is just a shorthand for this combination. Okay. Now you see, of course, if you take this derivative here and do it here, then you get what you get here is just minus gamma 2 lambda plus d2 gamma at least 4 d phi bar d phi inverse. So if you expand in the fields, you just can expand this in terms of that, and you get an equation which involves the full propagator and some vertices. So let me not write this out, but just show it to you graphically what this equation does. The equation, the graphical representation, as follows. Well, it's actually very easy. We have a So this would be the derivative of the two-point function. If we differentiate this term, we get some explicit term, which I just denote by this. It's just this q dot lambda. Well, let me write it explicitly, q dot lambda. Okay. And then what do we have to do to get two fields? Well, to have two fields left over, we have to have one with four fields here. We take two derivatives. Graphically, this just means we get this. And if you look what happens when you invert this, this line stands for something called S lambda, which is G lambda, Q dot lambda, G lambda. And then it goes on like this. So structure is very simple. You always take one with two more external legs, join them to form a loop. And then you can have other stuff too, because now we expand out. And this trace actually gives us basically an array of vertices, which we, for instance, can put like this. And then we have to close the trace with a line which gets differentiated. So this line is again an S lambda, and this line is a G lambda. So this just comes out from the geometric series which one develops here. And just for completeness, I also go on with the six-point function. So that, not surprisingly, has such a term. And then you get more and more terms, of course. I mean, you just have to count now the number of possibilities you have. But the first one is this, and then you get all kinds of stuff. So this would be the equation for the six-point function. And it goes on and on and on. Of course, it's an infinite set of equations for these functions. For every function, you just have a finite number of terms on the right-hand side, of course. So this is one version of it. If you look at Polchinski's equation, the structure is a little bit different because it's not for the one PI functions. In this differential equation, you see immediately that you can generate only one particle irreducible terms because all terms on the right-hand side are one particle irreducible. So every increment that you can produce in the equation has this property.
Manfred, the difference between this and Polchinski is that this is done for the Lejeune transform.
Yes. Yeah. This was first done by Wetterich some time ago. At least I believe he was the first. It's never clear. Probably Franz Wegener knows better how far these things go back. It's never easy to tell. And people also say that Polchinski's equation is actually due to Wilson, which may be true, but on the other hand, Polchinski did something very nice with it, so that's also the question what you do with an equation. Okay, so now we finish algebra and we come to analysis, which is about the question, what do we do now with this system of equations? It is an infinite system of equations, and it's not so trivial to say we just forget about some equations down here. So one has to know which terms are big and which terms are small. And here, of course, it really depends on the kind of theory you're studying, and now the things I'm going to say are specific to the many fermion models. The first thing one can do is one can convince oneself that one can generate perturbation theory by this formula. How does one do this? Well, you just truncate the system of equations at some order. Suppose we try to have an easy life, and this is this is what we're going to do, and life will be hard enough even doing this. Suppose we just throw away everything below here, and we remove this. So we're setting the six-point function to zero. Now this is the one PI six-point function. This means we're replacing the six and higher point functions by tree diagrams. Then if you look at this, then the system of equations, of course, closes. We just have an equation for the four-point function and the self-energy. Now, if you just think of integrating the differential equation, what this means, you integrate both sides and you have to plug in the initial condition. The initial condition is the original interaction. So if you expand in the original interaction, you get second order terms here. If you cut the line down here and remove this, you get it to third order. If you cut the line here and remove it, you get it to fourth order, and so on. So every truncation serves to generate perturbation theory to some order. And in fact, this is again something I cannot show here, but I want to remark. If one takes Polchinski's equation and does this, one gets, one generates perturbation theory, but not in some stupid sense, but in a very nice way. It's automatically arranged in a way so that terms that cancel, for instance, because of sign cancellations, cancel automatically. So the integration of the RG equation gives you a formula for perturbation expansions, which is extremely useful. Now, for the 1PI, this is not known, but it's likely to be true. Okay, so in perturbation theory, we know that we can generate it by this hierarchy. Even though these things all look as one-loop equations, we can generate everything with it. But now the question is, which terms are big and which terms are small? And if we are at weak coupling, of course, everything is determined by the kinetic energy part. So let's assume for the first, for the moment, that that we leave out the self energy. This term here is sigma dot lambda. This is the derivative of self energy. If we assume that there is no self energy, well, then things are easy. Then G lambda is just the bare one times the cutoff function, and S lambda, what I called here, is its derivative with respect to lambda. Now remember, I showed you this cutoff function. What this now means, if we go to momentum space, so this would be the first Brillouin zone, and let's suppose we have some weird Fermi surface here. Then this means, I mean, everything at weak coupling is governed by this function here. And this function can get, of course, very large. And so what we're doing here is we're going to a certain scale, lambda, and looking at the neighborhood of the level set where, for instance, E of P is equal to lambda. So this is some. Since we have a smooth cutoff function, the single scale propagator lives on such a momentum shell. So this would be the Fermi surface where E of P is zero. And at the scale lambda, we are in this, the action is in this region here. And if you want to draw a picture about how this propagator looks when we go along this line, well, of course, it looks like 1 over x, and then we have a cutoff function which makes some kind of bump here, and the same thing on the other side. Okay. And now you see there are basically two ingredients in this. You have functions. I mean, if you now think of evaluating such loop integrals, you have functions that get very large, but they get very large in a very small region. And as you know, in loop integrals, you start shifting this around, so you get intersections of such thin shells. And these intersections depend very strongly on the geometry of the Fermi surface.
Sorry, I would have thought your chi cutoff would go up just as you showed and then just kind of flatten off.
No, the chi cutoff. The chi is zero here, essentially, and like this.
Thanks.
And the chi dot is there.
This is a function of what's on the x-axis?
Yes.
So you take some radial distance from the Fermi surface. So this would basically be the plot of 1 over E of P, right, if you go in this direction. You just, I mean, you have this in the denominator. Of course, this blows up here. Because of the finite temperature, which we have, it will eventually level off, but things will depend very strongly on the temperature. And I mean, in one way, it is the RG in this version is just chopping this function into little pieces and then looking, adding them up, and see how things grow when you approach the singularity. Okay. So from this kind of
can you explain why is it asymmetric? Why is the cutoff asymmetric around the Fermi surface?
Why is it asymmetric?
It's not asymmetric. It's just a function.
It's just badly drawn. Okay. It's not asymmetric. Okay. You could choose it asymmetric if you wanted to, but there's no reason now.
Okay.
Now one can go through this in a lot of detail, and I will spare you this detail because the result is very simple. The result says one can, for the full hierarchy of equations, one can get power counting laws which tell you the functions that are, in the RG sense, relevant are the 2 and the 4-point function. This is a weak coupling statement. It's not a statement about strong coupling, but the statement is really 2 and 4-point functions are, 4-point function is marginal, 2-point function is relevant, everything else is irrelevant. That's the first statement you get, and if you dig into more details, you find out that of all the complicated stuff that goes into the 4-point function, it's only this thing which is important.
Okay.
Yeah.
The statement is independent of dimensionality.
I'm just saying what it depends on. It is not true in one dimension.
Okay.
And in higher dimensions, it requires that you don't have perfect nesting. You have to have some curvature on the Fermi surface. So exactly, this is in fact why weak coupling studies of singular Fermi surfaces are interesting and not so trivial, because there all this breaks down and you don't know for sure what's going on. But as long as you have curvature, one can actually show that this thing here matters only at momentum, total momentum zero, and this will then turn out to be the Cooper channel and everything. So it all comes out completely in a natural way from the RG. So, upshot of this analysis, which is complicated, is simple. You can try to draw a line here and study this system of equations. This is an approximation, but in some cases, it is known to be a valid approximation. And I think at this point, I will just go over to
Scott. The Cooper channel is the one you say then that's dominating it.
Yeah.
But somehow you're going to start with a finite coupling in order to bring in the competition. Otherwise, would you ever be able to bring in the competition without a singular Fermi surface?
Okay. I think that you made 2 points in your question. The first one is these are all statements which, I mean, this kind of power counting I described, this kicks in when you approach the Fermi surface. That is when lambda gets small, when you get really close to the Earth. When you are far away, you don't know this. If you're far away from the Fermi surface, all that helps you in this system of equations is that the coupling is small. otherwise you don't know anything. But if the coupling is small, you all, on the other hand, you know that everything is well controlled until you get close to the singularity, and then this this statement about the Cooper channel kicks in. So, before I go to the projection, to the beamer, I should say, what if sigma lambda is not zero? Now, sigma lambda not zero, this is the relevant perturbation. This is the way the Fermi surface deforms. This is a technically quite hard problem, but it has been studied in the case I just indicated, and one can show that the deformation of the Fermi surface is regular, and that the Z factor is close to one. The Fermi velocity gets a small correction. Everything is completely regular. So maybe I give a summary of these results. Going over to this beam thing. So here we are. Okay. So what I just described are the so-called easy cases. Is there a pointer? So what has been done with some variant of this method? First of all, the 1D Luttinger and Hubbard model have been completely nailed down mathematically by the Italian group around Galavotti and Benfatto. So they proved that the Luttinger exponents are what they are supposed to be, and so on. Now, in two dimensions, one can show this power counting non-perturbatively. This goes back to a paper by Feldman and company beginning of the 90s. And the interesting thing is you can show it only when you start doing an angular decomposition on your Fermi surface. This is interesting because this is exactly the thing one does in numerical studies afterwards. So what one looks at is one chops the angular degree of freedom around the Fermi surface in little pieces and studies the, one would say in physical terms, the scattering between the pieces. Okay, Fermi surface.
That's sort of angular. Yeah. I mean, Fermi surfaces can have any shape. They can be oval, they can be this, they can be.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. Take something like this. Then you have an angle.
I understand that.
If you have.
If you use coordinates along the surface and perpendicular to the surface, or what does it mean?
Yes, it means the following. It means that as you will see, all our functions depend on angle and everything else. And if you want to get through with your power counting in a way that you cannot just do it diagram by diagram, but really show that things are, remainders are small, you have to cut the Fermi surface into little pieces. The only way one has found it to work. And in fact, what one does when one is at scale lambda, one chooses the angular extension of this sector to be square root of lambda.
Sorry, I don't know what angle means. I mean, you have a center of inversion here, something like that. I mean, one thing would be the differential geometry, a local geometry on the piece of Fermi surface. But you, of course, have to couple this guy with some guy far away. And that's what in the end. I mean, sorry, I just.
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Angle. These topological.
Angle is just you pick a point. Suppose the Fermi surface is closed around this point.
It's not closed, or it consists of 10 little pieces, or what? It doesn't matter, or what matters.
It consists of 10 little pieces. You have to choose 10 points and put angles around these points.
And in fact, probably the answer is that this has been applied to very simple cases at this point with where the Fermi surface is singly connected and it can.
Yes, it's just, I mean, if you take a very complicated Fermi surface.
Parametrized by one angle.
So your answer is the whole thing is sufficiently complicated that this is the case as which has been studied and where you know.
Well, it's not so bad. I mean, you can, if you want to have this too, you can treat it too. I mean, that's not the problem. The real problem is.
The problem is, you started out saying about some considerations, yes, perfect nesting and this and that. If you have the saddle point, which is a extension of that thing, what they know.
I was saying, regular curved Fermi surface, no saddle points, no such thing. This is the hard case. These are the easy cases. Okay, anyway, if you are in such a simple situation, you choose these patches of this size. So at scale lambda, you have 1 over square root of lambda of these patches. And in fact, one can show that one can do a 1 over n expansion where this square root of lambda inverse is n. And it's really 1 over n expansion in the sense of a vector model. Okay. There are many details one can do. Maybe I should mention also here that one can also clarify what goes on in the zero temperature limit. These are old problems. So-called anomalous diagrams, these problems are not really there if you renormalize correctly. There is a proof of Fermi liquid behavior above a temperature which looks like the ECS temperature due to De Satori and Rivasseau in Paris. And there is even a proof of zero temperature Fermi liquid behavior if you have a particular Fermi surface for which the Cooper channel is absent. All this is weak coupling. All this is extremely hard work. This alone is 600 pages of work without trivialities. So, I mean, it's sort of, even though it's weak coupling, it's not completely trivial. So now let's look at the things that are more interesting for people here, maybe.
Before you go on, I just have a question. In all these works, I guess there is an assumption that all interactions are completely regular.
Yes. Has short range interactions.
Were these sort of singular, or has this never been looked at?
Has been studied, but never published. I mean, it's of course the evidently from physics, one would be interested in coupling transverse gauge fields to these things. And then, I mean, after doing an RPA, let me say it that way, Trubowitz had a student who proved that things work out when you do the first RPA to get this initial screening. The screening is, of course, it's not real screening because it's frequency dependent. But he then never wrote it up and went into algebraic geometries. Nothing has been published from the let's say side where everything is proven. Of course, there was an extensive discussion of this in the literature, but I don't think it's conclusive as to what really goes on.
Question: yeah? Why square root of lambda? I mean, is that crucial to choose that?
Lambda 2/3 is too big. Essentially it is because you have something which has a curvature here. If you want to have it technically, the main problem in this is if you work with these kinds of equations and you may generate a humongous diagram with it, then you somehow you don't want to look at the details, you have to estimate it somehow. So you put in absolute values. Now, if you put in absolute values and are not careful, you're dead immediately because these things oscillate and you lose a lot. The only way one found out to to do this is to put in these angular sectors. And if you look at the decay in this direction, you do a stationary phase, and that's where the square root of lambda pops out in a very obvious way. Okay, so hard cases. Everything I said becomes very suspicious when you have nesting. So, for instance, in the half-filled Hubbard model, everything I said so far requires that you do not have Fraunhofer singularities, or you're not near to them. And while Umklapp scattering is some thing that came up in a very technical point in the analysis, but which is obviously physically also important. So why are these the hard cases? Well, they're the cases where the methods did not obviously lead to the same bounds. And also it inevitably happens, except for 1D, where one has this cancellation in the usual Luttinger situation where the beta function vanishes. The flow always runs to strong coupling. I mean, this situation is already present in the easy case, and is the reason for this restriction, because eventually the Cooper coupling gets you and it runs away, so you cannot prove anything about a Fermi liquid below this temperature. So the fact that things run away to strong coupling by itself is actually something that almost always happens in these models. For the method, this just means that eventually you will not be able to describe it by this set of equations anymore. One has to stop at some scale.
But is this flow to strong coupling just the result of some Cohn-Luttinger type of instability, or is there something deeper than that?
Well, the easiest and well understood case is the Cohn-Luttinger instability. What I'm going to show you, the runaway has many different features, and it's not clear whether it immediately leads to some kind of ordering or opening of gaps, or whether the situation is more complicated. I mean, I don't know that.
What I want to know is you have a Cooper channel there, and that thing is bound to grow because there's always something. Is that all
Umklapp can grow? Or, I mean, when you have Umklapp or nothing,
it does grow, in fact, yeah.
In a singular fashion? I mean,
they grow.
You will see.
But do they grow because of kinematics, or because it's only the Cooper channel which has enough phase space?
That's why you put no nesting.
Right, but he's in the guise of no nesting.
No, this is now the.
Okay.
Yeah, now if you have no nesting, then sure. The Cooper channel is the only one.
Yeah, okay. In the standard case, it's just so the statement flow always to strong coupling. In the standard case, yeah. That's basically the Cohn-Luttinger thing,
right.
Put here or ever on a much more
right. Okay, so now you have the logs from the nesting from the Cooper channel and from the Van Hove singularity.
Let's see.
Does Umklapp also have some? You need Umklapp in combination with these two things to get singular behavior, right?
Umklapp starts much, much earlier, of course. I mean, think of the torus, right? I mean, it doesn't take a very large density to get across, to get to a 2 pi, the momentum conservation up to 2 pi.
Right, but that's only singular if you have these other two ingredients,
yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Umklapp in itself is nothing particular.
Right.
Okay. So maybe I can clear that. I don't even know what Umklapp means. Yeah. Sorry.
Umklapp means momentum conservation up to a multiple of the reciprocal.
I have a specific example we have on the blackboard.
Yes.
If you close this thing around technically about the M point instead of about the gamma point, because you started your sector where you started in your practical implications, you start by your origin at the gamma point instead of the M point. I mean, that sounds non-relevant. Is that your? I mean, this discussion on the height CC type two-dimensional things, I see this discussion of Umklapp. I don't really understand what the point is, couldn't you just put yourself at m instead of a gamma and everything would have been easy, or does it mean that the club means you're close to the Fermat?
Well, suppose you have a Fermat surface like this.
Yeah.
Now you calculate any such diagram, you won't see any momentum conservation except the strict conservation. Now you increase the density. At some point, you reach a density where you where the contributions become important, right? Because if the Fermat surface, let's see.
Yeah, but you couldn't have done that on the.
If it touches one of its
transverse. You couldn't have done this unless you have a Van Hove singularity separate these things.
Oh no, let me say the following way. Suppose you have your copies of translational copies of the Brillouin zone, and you choose your density such that if you take two times the Fermi surface, you touch here. That's, for instance, a point where the self energy gets umklapp contributions for the first
times.
Yeah, but you could only just mean that you couple across the Fermi circuit. 2K is bigger than the reciprocal landscapes or whatever. Is that what you mean?
No, if you are at a smaller density, you see this situation is relevant for the discussion, for instance, of this contribution to the self energy. And if the density is smaller, then you just never reach there. So you can't get close to the Fermi surface by adding two momenta, which you're doing here, right? You have two loop momenta, and the third one is the sum of three momenta. So then you only have a momentum conservation as if there were no periodicity. But once you get beyond a certain density, these things start to contribute, and they change things. And of course, here's the point. Of course, they don't change things in a singular way unless you have this Van Hove and other things as well. But for instance, there was a funny observation that when Walter Metzner and a student of his, Christoph Halbod, calculated the Fermi surface deformation, and they found that the deformation changes exactly, well, numerically, pretty much exactly at this point where this geometrical touching happens.
But even if you have a very small number of electrons in your Fermi surface,
yes,
the Fermi surface is always, or is it not, periodic in reciprocal space, so you can always couple from this little patch and over to that little patch. It's just that you don't consider it or what.
But you count at 4kF, it's much, much less than the reciprocal aspect.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, I mean, from the cases, I mean, this is just extremely small ones where it doesn't matter. In realistic cases, you know.
You're right. It's just funny that in the deformation of the Fermi surface that.
Yeah, okay.
This is about 0.6, if you think of t prime equal to zero, filling 0.6, you get over this.
It's clear that usually umklapp is there, but they themselves do not need necessarily to singular, right?
Yeah.
It's actually only nesting in Van Hove, which sort of gets sometimes similar.
Oof, okay, time is. Well, I think there's a tradition in this workshop to cram 5 talks into one, so I will do this too.
Ask too many questions.
Okay. So I should mention that there are many people working on this. I've been mainly working with Onakamp, Rice, and Furukawa. There's Walter Metzner's group. He has worked with the student Christoph Halbot, and he's also working with Daniel Rohe, who is also here on continuation of his project. The first people to do it actually for these models were Zanke and Schulz. And then there were a number of other people, Vince and company, Bourbonnais. These people have done one-dimensional study. So this list is by no means complete. There are many I just wrote down a list to have at least some people. Okay. So let's now, what we're now going to do is the following. We're going to say, okay, whatever, although we don't know what goes on down here, really, we just focus on this. Yeah. So we have an equation for the four-point function, which is this equation, a one-loop equation, which is probably half hidden behind this screen here. And well, just to show you, we have now to deal with a function of three momenta, three frequencies, spins. Now, of course, the spin dependence you can easily take out. You just this drawing of a vertex just means that the spin is conserved along the lines. It does not mean that this is just an exchange of a particle with a trivial vertex function. This still depends on three independent momenta. Okay, so this means then that the four-point function equation gets all these terms, and the two-point function gets these Hartree and Fock type diagrams. Okay. Now, you see then that this becomes a functional differential equation because we're studying the flow of a function, and on the right-hand side we feed in a lot of terms, and I go back for a second. We have a number of particle hole terms here and the particle term. Of course, they all depend on these bubbles here, depend on different transfer momenta, and they all get mixed up in case the flow is really coupled. So we have to study this dependence on the three momenta in some detail. And what we do is by RG arguments, we project to omega equal to zero and to momentum on the Fermi surface. So this means one can argue basically by Taylor expansion and weighing small factors in the numerator against the denominator that one can study this function on the Fermi surface only to get the leading flow. So in other words, for instance, for this situation, TT prime Hubbard model, we choose a coordinate system. And here you see we already also choose an angular discretization because we can, of course, not deal with the flow in a function space. And then we project onto the Fermi surface. Now, to say right away, I mean, these are arguments which are in principle true, but the projection is an approximation which has to be discussed separately.
Is there a numerical approximation? Because the finiteness here is greater than you are.
Yeah, see, the basic question is you have a function of three independent momenta and frequencies. You have to get out what parts are important of it. Now, by power counting arguments, get the leading part, you can restrict yourself to the Fermi surface. Now, to deal with such a function, now you still have to parameterize this function of some angles. Now you have to choose a way of doing it. And so far, the way one has chosen following Zanke and Schulz is just discretization. You can think of many things, I mean, expanding in sets of functions and so on. They are not really simpler, and they get very messy. Here, if you do it that way, you have a good idea of you know, which particle couples to which one. And also, one has in the back of one's mind that this method is also the right one if you really want to study it analytically, except that, of course, numerically, one can never increase the number of patches as the scale decreases. Keep it up, the number of patches just gets too large. I mean, if we now discretize, for instance, I don't know how many this is, but typically one takes something like 48 points. Then you take three independent angles, 48 cubed, take out some symmetries, you end up with several thousand coupling constants which couple different parts of the Fermi surface. So evidently this is not a very, actually this looks like a really stupid way of doing things, right? But it's has so far been the best way of doing things.
Because you haven't tried anything else or because it's too hard?
I think because it didn't put in any prejudice as to what is happening. Now that one knows a little bit of what's happening.
Well, I mean, having sort of normal coordinates with, let's say, I mean, scaling with the velocity of the Fermi surface, having many points close to these zero points.
Oh yeah, I mean we also did something where the density of points gets higher. Yeah, sure.
But I mean, you couldn't sort of have normal, you know, in the Fermi surface, you know, having a coordinate system which is suited for that Fermi surface. I mean, you have.
Well, the separation moment and tangential has already been done.
That's
the tangential variables are quite a few and everything goes to the third power.
It's just a surface rather than a point.
Three independent momenta.
It doesn't matter, you're saying. So phase space, I mean, dividing it up so that so let's say each part of the surface or each for surface area scale so that you have the same phase space.
Well, you're of course right that one would prefer to do things such that the density of points you have here gets higher when you go closer to this thing. And this was also, we also did that. We didn't always take the same angular decomposition just as a check. But of course, I mean, it's always, this is always an approximation which one has to watch. I mean, the best one could do is just check how it depends on discretization, and depends too strongly, you don't believe your results. Okay. So, now we have to go one step back before we discuss some data. The step back is, of course, well, this you can argue for the leading part of the flow, but if you want to calculate the function itself, the one particle irreducible function, it's of course nonsense to say that it's constant in radial direction. So if you really want to study the response to some observables, you have to couple them in and let them flow, and the flow is then just dragged along by the flow of the coupling functions. Now, why does one do this? One does it because, of course, if you have 10,000 coupling constants, 8,000 of which get large, you have to find a way of deciding what you want to do, what is relevant. So one couples the usual response to external fields. So for instance, one puts into the Hamiltonian something with a pairing field and a function H, which describes the symmetry of the gap. So this means that as an initial condition for this function H, which now will depend on the flow parameter, one puts maybe the simplest D waveform you can have, cosine K1 minus cosine K2. But then you allow this to develop as a function of K as you run along. And in the similar way, you can, of course, put in an S-wave gap or whatever you want, and you can check if it gets large. Now, the result was invariably that, well, in the situation that was drawn before, that it is the D-wave which is important, so I didn't write down the other ones. Well, then one can check for antiferromagnetism. And the density wave, and also the Pomeranchuk instability that Walter Metzner and Christoph Halbold found. So you can study a lot more functions, and let's just look what happens.
So you include those as like source terms in the effective action?
Yes.
And then you keep track of those extra functions.
Except that this function which couples here is treated, you treat the functions in an expansion in phi, right? So you see this phi here would be this line in this diagram. and you don't start integrating over the phi, but you just leave it as an external source, and then it just gets, it's just a linear differential equation, which is determined by the growth of the coupling function. It's just that you you now ask for a certain response, and you get a simple answer for one function instead of a complicated coupling function.
Matthew, can you say more about this form of the perturbing term for the homeoentropic instability? If the wave vector was not going to zero as you wrote, but was by pi, this would be eta pairing or this of pairing.
There is one dagger tumultuation.
There are too many daggers.
Yeah, that's okay. True. Yeah. There is
one
dagger too much. This is not. Yeah, that's right. That's true too. I don't know about the pi. I never thought about it.
Okay, no, but I was confused by the two daggers. That was my question.
Yeah, no. And of course, here you could in principle also put in, I mean, what kind of, whether you call it D-wave just means you sort of offer to the system that you have a D-wave symmetry, and then you see if anything grows. You could also check S-wave, but you won't get much out of it. Okay. So.
Is it complete? Isn't there a diagram missing? You cut it in half, but you could also connect one line from the right to one line to the left.
Yeah, I think this is because I thought of this as the spin density coupling, and then you don't have the bubble which closes. I mean, you're right that you could think of such a diagram. Right, that's what you're thinking
you
about.
You have the dotted line, and then you close the solid line around.
Yeah, that's what I was drawing here. This is what's this.
I don't know what you're
talking about. The invisible. You mean like this?
Right? No, I mean, you have the.
What do you mean?
It's only half the interaction, so you can have two together. Okay.
No, this is not an interaction. You see, this is not something that gets integrated. This is an internal line. These are just external fields. You put in an external field and you just, this is exactly, I mean.
You have to decouple your four Fermi interaction.
No. This is not like this. The flow of the interaction is still given by this function, which is shown here with the four fermions coming in and going out. What is here is just you. Okay, two or four, whatever you call it. It's a two-particle function and a four-point function, if you do. This is just an external field which you use to generate. I mean, suppose you take this phi and put it up in the exponent and take two derivatives with respect to phi. You get a correlation function of these pairs, right? This is just a device to study the correlations of D-wave pairs of anti-ferromagnetic spins and so on. It is not an internal field. It's not obtained by Hubbard-Stratonovich transformation.
It's just that's the usual flow equation of a response vertex, which you get when you put in some composite operator in your language. Flow of some composite.
How am I supposed to make connection to this flow of the four-point function in the four external fermion fields?
Logic doesn't change, it's just in the condition.
If you think of this function, right, momenta and frequencies are included here. This, in principle, gives you the four-point function in all the Brillouin zone. So if you want now to calculate the spin correlation, you just make a contraction and take a suitable combination of this V lambda. However, this V lambda is not what one can calculate with the effort we can put in. What we did is we projected this to the Fermi surface. Now you cannot just recalculate from this the correlation of two Cooper pairs, for instance. Because you have too little information. I mean, you cannot assume that the function is really doesn't depend on the radial variable. So the price you pay for this simplification is that to get back the information about the p dependence here, you have to study a response function. And this is exactly the function which the type of functions that is done here. So the flow is done only for the couplings which are close to the Fermi surface, and to get back the momentum dependence over the Brillouin zone, one studies these response functions. Okay. Well, let's go briefly through some results and then quit. I would divide the results in results everyone agrees on and other results. And I will start with those things that everyone agrees on first. So here are some different densities. As you see, Fermi surface moves closer and closer to this Van Hove point. And I'll just show you a picture of the E-wave and anti-ferromagnetic susceptibility. And you see, we go, unfortunately, we have to go back and forth between this. The closer we go here to this Van Hove singularity, the more the D-wave grows. Now, this is a relatively safe prediction because we don't actually have any change. There is nowhere where this line, this is the antiferromagnet, this is the D wave, crosses the other one. So in this, D wave is clearly leading over antiferromagnetic, leading over everything else. And here it's the other way around. And here with our flow, we could not determine any difference between the two. Now there is this triangle which I put in here, which tells you that at this point the coupling constants are twice the bandwidth, and at this point at the latest we decide to stop. Now, where you stop your flow is of course a matter of debate. Some people integrate it all the way to the singularity, which sits somewhere here, so then your couplings are infinite, and you can decide whether you still believe your results, but we just decided to stop when the couplings are not getting too large, because then there is no justification at all for using such a system of equations when the couplings get very, very large.
How big is U?
U is 3.
And there are 2 blue and 2 black lines.
Yes. The thin lines are the bare susceptibilities, meaning those when you don't flow the couplings. Okay, so from this this is a work of Carsten Honakamp, Maurice Reiss, Rukava, and myself, we got a diagram which tells us the following. This red line here is a line above which no coupling flows gets very strong. So if the temperature gets high enough, you don't have any instability. And now we can go down in temperature and look at the susceptibilities. And this, what we call approximate nesting regime, is really the antiferromagnet. And this is where the D-wave susceptibility is leading. This is the middle regime. One can have a theory about this middle regime, but I will refrain from discussing it right
what
now.
What does E-wave mean? What kind of?
E-wave pairing, superconductivity, yeah. Now, as you can imagine from the method by which this is gotten from, I mean, you cannot draw a sharp line here because you can start discussing where should we really stop the flow and everything. So there is some uncertainty as to where these lines really are, if they are real transition lines. Well, let me show you one excerpt of the work of Walter and Christoph Halbot. They studied also the TT prime Hubbard model. Their U was, I think, 1.5, and T prime is 0.01, whereas we had 0.3. And
the diagram on the left-hand side, U is, of course, a variable.
Oh, yeah. In this diagram, U is 1.5, yeah. And this U is a variable, and what they also get is spin density wave, antiferromagnet, and dx squared minus y squared, depending on how, where you are. This value 0 is the Fraunhofer filling. So you get some window of antiferromagnetism, which gets smaller as the initial U gets smaller, and then you have some D wave. So I think there is little doubt. I mean, other groups got this too. These two features pop out in about any flow. Now, there are some things that are under debate. There's the possibility of a Pomeranchuk instability.
Can you tell us what that is? Sorry, don't tell me what it is.
Yes, it is a breaking of the discrete rotational symmetry in the way that the Fermi surface, well, is no longer rotation symmetric. In an extreme case, it would sort of close around zero here and still around pi pi. So it would have this shape, right? It's definitely a possibility. And actually, Walter and Christoph Halbot studied this in this paper, and they pointed out that this is possible. The system has this instability too. It is, however, very difficult to study with this momentum cutoff flow, because if you cut off the momenta near the Fermi surface, you suppress all instabilities which are near to momentum zero. That means this and also the ferromagnet.
This instability is going from a closed Fermi surface to something which has two sheets. And
not necessarily. It can just be an asymmetry. In fact, Walter will discuss more tomorrow a more detailed calculation he did with Anne Neumeier on whether this occurs or not. Now, in this RG business, it's not so easy to compare this directly, because if you cut off things, you suppress these instabilities at Q equal to zero. We did a flow where the temperature is the flow parameter to compare different instabilities and also to check some things. And okay, this is, unfortunately, I put it in yesterday evening, so there is no labeling and nothing. So this is T prime minus 0.25 T. And this just means here the Fermi surface is basically so it's like this, so it doesn't reach the 0.0 pi. And as we go along here, it goes further out and then comes closed around pi pi. So that's the direction this thing here moves. The blue line is superconductivity, D wave. Black line is antiferromagnetism. The red line is D density wave. And the purple line is the Pomeranchuk instability. So in the flow that we did here, the Pomeranchuk appears to be weaker than the other instabilities. Now, okay, I mean, we can have a long debate about this. One obvious argument why these both these instabilities breaking discrete symmetries should be less suppressed is that they are just discrete symmetries, whereas these things, if there is order, it breaks a continuous symmetry, which is pretty difficult at a positive temperature in two dimensions. So actually, I mean, the approximation in which these flows are done doesn't capture this. So let's see what happens. Well, as I said, Walter and Anne Neumeier had studied this in the normalized perturbation theory. In particular, the question how superconductivity, D-wave, of course, and Pomeranchuk influence each other, and I guess he will discuss this tomorrow. In detail, there is a density region, a small density range, where the Pomeranchuk seems to be the strongest. Well, one question that always came up was ferromagnetism. We add the Van Hove singularity and look at the Stoner criterion, it tells us immediately there must be ferromagnetism. Well, we looked at it with the temperature flow, and we found it depends on T prime over T. Indeed, if T prime over T gets large enough, remember when it gets 0.5, you have a square root singularity of the density of states, so then the density of states is really hugely divergent. It depends on T prime.
That because of the feeling you chose.
Yeah, sorry. I should have said this is always at the Van Hove filling. This plot is fix the density at the Van Hove filling and look how it depends on T prime over T.
So the density is changing as you
were. Density changes everywhere. And
well, you said you're always sitting, the fermi level is always at the Van Hove singularity.
Because, of course, the Van Hove singularity also gives a bigger weight to the Cooper channel, just by the log it has. But, ferromagnetism should be favored there, too. But, at least the RG tells you that ferromagnetism appears only up here.
And some sketch of how the Fermi surface looks like in the various regimes. Are there some qualitative features that look different?
No, it's just that that I'll just draw this. I'll just draw the neighborhood of the zero pi point, right? If T prime is equal to zero, you just have two orthogonal lines, and then this angle gets smaller. If you reach 1/2, we have this sort of cubic curve.
Oh, it's what?
It's always there. It's just
at the end of.
There is always a double point on the curve, but here it becomes a real cusp. In terms of the density of states, it means it's always logarithmically divergent until you reach this point where it becomes a square root. So in fact, the coefficient of this logarithm gets larger until it diverges at that point. And it seems to be really a question of T prime over T, whether the ferromagnetism is really strong enough to dominate. The funny feature of this is that this really goes down to the precision we could do it. We never found any flow to anything.
Did you ever look for a T wave?
Pardon?
Did you look for a T wave?
Yes, you find it near the an overfilling. If you go a little bit away, ferromagnetism dies very quickly and you get a T wave. Okay. Well, so let me wrap up with a few remarks. What does this flow to strong coupling mean? Well, it means that, of course, instabilities are incipient. It doesn't mean that the approximation gets bad when the couplings get below beyond order one, but I wouldn't believe this flow once they get more than twice the bandwidth. So the bandwidth, we should just stop it. So it's an open question how we can improve things to do this. But of course, is actually the thing one believes is that there is no real flow to weak coupling, to strong coupling, but it's just because we haven't allowed the system to actually get the gaps. And of course, if you offer the system a gap, it will just increase the gap and the couplings will not diverge. Well, this is a largely unfinished story to understand this in detail and also to understand it beyond the mean field level, so I never published it, so maybe someday we'll know how it goes. The other thing which I didn't tell you is that the results I told you did not take into account the self-energy. And so the question is, how big is the self-energy? Well, in this older paper, we already studied the deformation of the Fermi surface with a flow that sort of dynamically takes that into account. And it turned out that when the density is kept fixed, the Fermi surface deformation is very small. It does have the tendency to decrease T prime, but it is very small. And then there are, of course, the other effects of the self-energy, like the Z factor, which, of course, was studied by Zanke. And he did, although only for the half-field case, with T prime equal to zero, and he found a pretty strong suppression of Z. On the other hand, he integrated his flows to very, very large values of the coupling constants. Now, we have played around with this a little bit too, not just for half filling. The result we have is, as long as the couplings do not get out of the range that I showed you, the Z factor does not get very small. So, in a sense, this is it's a partial justification for dropping it from the start if you feed it back in.
How does it vary along the Fermi surface?
Oh, it gets suppressed at these pi zero points in diagonal. It stays larger. Yeah. But the effect is not really very strong, and in some sense this is of course disappointing. Although it lends some support to leaving it out at first, but it's this self energy study. Yeah, no. Obviously, I'm not experienced in self-consistency, right? So, let's see. I mean, in any event, I think this line is the most important of this this picture here. There is a number of things that are not completely clear yet. For instance, whether the Van Hove singularity actually extends as a consequence of this flow is not clear to us yet. We just haven't done the calculation well enough to know this.
But wouldn't it worry you? I mean, this extended saddle point, which you reach at whatever 0.5 T.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you calculate the area of that Fermi surface, that is 80% filled. I mean, you don't have something like 10% filled over, you're 80%. The volume is huge, so it is, well, just for mathematical study, it's fine, but it seems to have little to do with the ICCs.
I mean, of course, no. I mean, there was just the question. I mean, it's an obvious question. If you are playing around in a situation where you have diverging density of states, you have to worry about ferromagnetism. And it was partly a question for the method, because you cannot study it with any type of flow you do. You cannot study this easily with a flow with an infrared cutoff, which cuts off near the Fermi surface. What we did is we did a flow in the temperature variable, which formally is, you know, just do the same. You play a little trick at the beginning to shift all temperature dependence in the quadratic part, and then you can derive a flow equation for it. Then you don't have this problem. On the other hand, you have a bigger problem with the approximation given with the projection onto the Fermi surface. So one has to see. And this is just, I mean, just to see if, I mean, ferromagnetism was also discussed by other people in Hartree-Fock and T-matrix improved Hartree-Fock. We just wanted to compare. Of course, we don't regard this as realistic for that.
But of course, in a real system, where you have phonons, you could of course breaking the symmetry in other ways, but it doesn't have to be ferromagnets.
So, where's the strong couple theory?
Not particularly accessible, I would say.
In the spirit of top-to-bottom approach, it's still below us, of course. We'll see. Ask me again in 60 years. Okay, that's it.